Thanks for tuning in to the Roundtable Podcast. This is episode 28. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robinson.
And I'm Doc Coleman, back again to fill in for Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
On the Roundtable Podcast, we invite writers to come on the show and present a story idea to us and to our esteemed guest host.
And then we unwrap it like a Christmas package. We lay it out and examine the rare jewels, the fine intricacies, all the elements, the bits, the treasures, the glowy, sparkly things. And then we what do, Doc? We kind of like reassemble, or we look at this and say, ooh, but what if?
And we mine the pyrite of speculative fiction looking for literary gold.
I love that phrase. You, sir, are a poet.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Doc. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's good to have you sitting in the co-pilot chair, man.
It's good to be here again. Yes.
What's going on in your life these days? What are you working on?
Actually, right now, I'm in a rest phase between completing the first draft of my first novel and getting ready to start edits. I think I'm probably gonna get started edits in the next couple weeks. I've actually got a short story that I did for the Every Photo Tells podcast that I need to get ready for self-publishing first.
Excellent.
And I'm going to throw that up on Amazon with the other one I already have up there.
Yeah.
And then it's back into edits.
The Every Photo Tells website is awesome. Guys, if you have not seen this, they put up a picture at the beginning of the month and then invite everyone to come up with some short fiction of any kind, form, shape, genre, whatever, and submit it for consideration, for inclusion on the website. And, Doc, do they also do a podcast?
Yeah, you submit your story, and if they like your story, they will do the audio podcast reading of your story.
That's brilliant.
And I did three stories for them last year, and they all got nominated for Parsec Awards, but unfortunately, none of them made them to the final five.
Well, but still, that's fabulous. What a great concept. Do you know the URL for them off the top of your head?
I believe it's everyphototells.com.
Ding. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. So friends, definitely check that out if you're looking for a little photo story prompt to get the juices flowing.
If you're looking for a little inspiration, that's a great place to start.
It really, really is. Definitely, definitely. And speaking of inspiration, speaking of cool ideas and where to go, let me, shall we roll on to our guest host, sir?
Oh, certainly we shall.
I think we ought. Friends, our guest host, you know her from her work, Super Villains, also, of course, the Parsec finalist for this year for speculative fiction, audio drama, long form, Mask of Inanna. We are pleased and proud to welcome back to the big chair at the round table, Alicia Goranson. Alicia, thanks for coming back and helping us workshop a story today.
What is happening? Thank you so much for having me back. I am thrilled and full of Red Bull, and I would love to give you all kinds of ideas.
Red Bull is all your right. Fuel of choice, eh?
Actually, it's water, but it sounds better.
There does seem to be some sort of an archetypal thing that Red Bull has become synonymous with power and energy and so on. That's good marketing. Alicia, you've got audio dramas behind you, you've got plays, you've got novels, short stories, essays. What is there anything that you're working on now or anything that you're projecting forward for in the world of Alicia Goranson?
Good Lord, I don't have a project that's coming out for like a couple of years, so you want me to spoil it on your show?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I have no problem with that. I'm working right now on a project which is basically a feminist Philip K. Dick postmodern story. It's going to be in three acts. It's called The Butler Saw Boobs.
The Butler yes. Saw Boobs.
The primary MacGuffin of the story is a mutoscope, which is otherwise known as a What the Butler Saw machine, which contains... which contains the first porno ever recorded back in 1896 on a camera that was blessed by the Pope at the time.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm not kidding.
A mutoscope or a nudoscope?
Mutoscope. M-U-T-O-scope.
Okay. I want to make sure I'm hearing it properly.
Right. And it's and the main villain of the story, one of his lines is, I will look into the mutoscope. I will see what the butler saw and be forever changed. And we all know what the butler saw.
Okay.
That's fabulous. Now, are you planning on that being an audio drama? Is that going to be a novel? How is that going to roll out?
I'm thinking about doing both. But as I said, I need the time to do it. It's an absolutely huge master project. Hopefully I'm going to be getting other authors in doing side stories for it. I want to make this a whole Butlerverse. I want to get out several audio dramas actually out of this if I can. As I said, it's still in the planning stages. I'm written up to about episode 13 out of, I think, like 50 or so. I'm going to be giving you more information about it. Don't worry. But it's gonna be incredible. It's gonna be rock your world. And if you're into conspiracy theories, if you're into stuff happening in 2142, if you're into body augmentation, if you're into replacing organs and limbs with all kinds of wonderful body parts, you know, making yourself into tours or snakes or whatever. That's all in there, but it's not cool because it's still a traditional American society in which everybody wants to still maintain, the perfect Jersey Shore type body. So, anyone else who's looking different is, freaks and whatnot. And basically the main impetus of the story is three great conspiracies called ecstasy, entropy, and economy. And each of them are trying to get at this mutoscope, which is in the basement of a mysterious BDSM sex club.
That sounds like X-Files meets... The Island of Dr. Moreau.
I have
the cat house of Dr. Moreau.
The cat house of Dr. Moreau.
I have a BDSM spanking scene that ends in a rap.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This has got to be audio. You've so got to do that in audio.
Oh, I'm gonna.
And you'll be posting developments on that on your website?
Heck yeah.
Awesome. That would be alicia-gorenson.com, correct?
Correct. However, one thing I want to add, you guys were saying in the last Friday, we were talking about some of the stuff I've done, one of which is Doctor Who and the Starship of Madness.
Right.
If you want to see it, we have it up. Just go to the Mask of Inanna website, themaskofinanna.com. No spaces, one word, and Inanna is I-N-A-N-N-A. We have a link to it, and we have the video for the whole show.
That's awesome.
Oh, very cool.
You can see us perform, and the actors have all dressed up. Even the doctor, he's got his own doctor suit on.
And let's talk about Mask of Inanna for just a second. At the time that this show actually airs, we'll actually have found out whether or not we will be graced with a Parsec Award or not, all of us. But I'm curious, are you going to try and make it down to Dragon Con for that?
We actually have one of the cast. Who's going down there. In fact, she's in two of the shows nominated in the same category. She was also in Second Shift, which is another fabulous podcast that I highly recommend. SecondShiftPodcast.com. No spaces, nothing, just SecondShiftPodcast.com. So as I said to her, she has a 40% chance of winning an award if she goes to that, awards dinner. And I'm hoping that she will leave her phone on, run it via Skype or whatever so that I can hear it.
There by proxy.
And necessarily. And me and Andrea, who is in charge of the second shift. If we're both on her Skype phone, then she can just hold it up in front of the mic. And
I was going to say, yes. Yeah. That would be the first acceptance speech delivered by cell phone.
I would love to be a part of that.
And why does that somehow seem so appropriate for podcast awards?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's fabulous. That's great. Well, Alicia, we will make sure all of this awesomeness gets into the liner notes for this post. So friends, you can definitely just scroll down just a little bit and see the links to all this gloriosity. And after we're done, feel free to click away and explore. But for now, we should probably take a brief pause for promotional consideration of yet another awesome podcast or fabulous ebook. And when we return, let's get into workshopping a story. Sound good?
Oh, yes.
Awesome. Let's. Then let's by all means do that. Friends, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
All right, folks, welcome back to the Roundtable Podcast. And now we're going to get into the meat, the tasty bits of this episode. So, Dave, if you would, could you introduce our guest writer for this week?
I would be most delighted, Sir Doc, because we can't do this without a courageous guest writer stepping forward and offering up their story for consideration. And for this week's episode, our guest writer hails from Halifax, England, and is currently developing not one but two serialized tales. One is called 59, an interstellar sci-fi adventure. And the other is Destiny's Daughter, an alien mystery series. And you can find the details for both of these epic works at www.anthonysunderland.com, which, of course, has given away the big reveal, because now we know that our guest writer is Anthony Sunderland. Tony, thank you so much, man, for stepping up and offering a story for consideration and discussion on the roundtable. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me along, Dave.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, Tony, what do you do anything other than writing? And why on earth did you suddenly delve into this writing world so vigorously?
I'm an electrician, and at the moment I'm working 3 days a week rather than five to give myself time to do the writing and all the promotional work involved. I got into it many years ago when I watched the series one finale of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it just blew me away. And I just thought, I want to write something that good. And if anybody told me at the time what was involved, you know...
Might have given it a second thought, huh?
I would have probably packed up right there and then if I'd known what I was in for. But I'm loving it. I've concocted a few stories and getting them out there in the big wide world now.
Outstanding. And you brought one to the table for us to... revel in and enjoy and discuss. Is that true?
That is, Dave. Yes.
That's good, because it's going to be a real short episode if you didn't.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, then, Tony, we're going to turn this over to you, sir. We're going to give you 5 to 8 minutes to give us your story presentation, give us title and genre, and is it going to be a short story or a novel or a part of a series? Tell us about the location, the characters, give us the basic plot arc that we can work with, and then we'll dive into it. The mic, sir, is all yours.
Thanks, Dave. Destiny's Daughter is a science fiction series. 23-year-old Dawn Dempsey is the latest recruit to the FBI's alien hunters. But what is the dark secret she's hiding from them? The theme of this story is about a need to belong, to be accepted, and feeling that your goals can never probably be achieved. The story is set in the present day, where the Alien Visitation Investigation Team, AVI, operates from a nondescript building on an industrial estate on the western outskirts of Chicago. It is directly over a large shaft leading down to a cave complex stretching thousands of square miles under the surrounding states. It is there because the Midwestern US is a hotspot for UFO sightings, mysterious happenings, and reports. This is the true Area 51, and the military allow people to continue speculating about the Nevada Air Force Base to keep them away from here. Characters: Dawn is a 15-year-old girl genetically programmed for accelerated growth, so she appears to be 23. She's an alien hybrid with exceptional eyesight in the dark, the ability to communicate telepathically and pick up other people's thoughts. She has degrees in astrophysics and quantum engineering and is a martial arts black belt. Her weaknesses include a strict moral code of an eye for an eye, which means that at times she acts impulsively to extract retribution. She is also without family or close friends. Although she's been taught what it means to be human and studied our nature, she has no real understanding or experience and doesn't fully understand the nuances of language and actions. She is on a mission to secure a new home for her people where they can live in peace. On a personal level, she yearns for her mother's acceptance and appreciation, but knows she cannot meet her until the mission is complete, if ever. Her allies include FBI Assistant Director Franklin S. Langan, a pugnacious 54-year-old former Gaelic football champion and Irish police chief. He is the head of AVI. He is chauffeur-driven in an armoured Range Rover equipped with heavy weapons, which was seized from a drug baron. Scott Nelson, 39, is Dawn's love interest and a senior field agent. He's in search of his own demons. Anne Jones is Dawn's childhood friend. She is also an hybrid and is the liaison with the aliens. Langan and Nelson are actually potential antagonists, because if they ever discover Dawn's true nature, they will be forced to take action against her. In a world of espionage and infiltration, the FBI's opponents are often her allies and vice versa. This is an introductory story of approximately 14,000 words. It's published on the Kindle and it is available to listen to on my website as a teaser for the series. It opens with Dawn in her spare bedroom, which is a shrine to her mother and a world she can never know. 94 minutes later, she sat in the back of a Range Rover on a deserted country highway with A.D. Langan and his driver, wondering if she is going to have to fight for her life and kill the two men. Langan tells her she's been called here 3 days before she is due to begin working for ABI because a UFO has crash-landed in nearby fields. The military have captured the Gray. It communicates telepathically to Dawn that there is an 8-year-old boy trapped in the wreckage. She single-handedly rescues the boy. After that, she wanders off alone in search of the co-pilot and finds it in a cave, badly injured. She tenderly embraces it, softly says, "I won't let anyone hurt you," then snaps his neck. AVI believe that the boy had been abducted, but Dawn knows that he was being delivered to his new family. This particular story ends with Dawn face to face with a Gray in her own apartment. She falls to the floor sobbing, apologising, killing the creature in the caves. Then her true nature and relationship with the murdered Gray are revealed. The series continues with Dawn infiltrating ABI. Each story will present a new mystery to investigate. While she tries to keep the boy's nature secret, plots to release the captive, and tries to keep the spaceship technology out of the military's hands. Dawn knows she can never go to bed with Scott, but they're inexorably drawn together, though something interrupts their passion each time they get close. What will the consequences be if they do sleep together? So that's that's a pitch.
Excellent. All right. I think there's some food for discussion here. A couple of things before we dive into it. Doc and Alicia, as Tony mentioned, this is a written story. But Tony and I have spoken, and we are free as workshoppers to assume that it's either A, not written, or can be rewritten. I don't want the fact that this has been a written and produced piece to in any way inhibit us from exploring the many different venues and avenues of exploration that will doubtless take us in the coming discussion. Is that cool with everybody?
That's fine, Dave.
Okay, Doc, Alicia, all right?
Yeah.
That's great. In fact, I mean, there's never a wrong time to edit. There's never a wrong time to revise. In fact, with War of the Foxes, my second book, I wrote 120,000 words of the first draft, decided it just wasn't working, threw it all out and restarted from scratch. So there's no reason, you know, why you can't do the same if you feel it's necessary. It's all about getting the work to be the highest quality it can be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. So our classic disclaimer that we need to put out there just to make sure that everyone is very clear. Tony, over the course of this discussion, there will be many suggestions, questions, explorations, what ifs that are thrown out by Doc, by Alicia, and by myself. And please do keep in mind that anything that emerges from any of our mouths might be complete and total bullshit. This is totally your story to do with and pursue as you see fit. We're just bringing our particular unique sensibilities to the table and offering it up as a possibility for your consideration. Is that cool?
That's fine, yes.
Excellent. Very good. Then we always defer opening comments and impressions to our guest host. So, Alicia, first impressions of Tony's tale, questions, points of clarification. Go ahead and kick off this discussion, if you would be so kind.
An X-Files-like Buffy story sounds like it has the potential for a lot of fun and a lot of interest in readers.
Epic.
I do enjoy the premise and the setup. As I said, I listened to the introduction for it. You also have a lot of fun with the data aspects of Dawn. You know, that you know, not able to understand what is this love of which you speak. I mean, I know it's more sympathetic with it's better in the version that you have. I'm just providing an example. You also, it sounds like it has a lot of connections with the Man Who Fell to Earth. Are you familiar with that movie?
Ooh, that's a good point.
With David Bowie.
Yes.
That's the one. Yes.
Basically, like looking for a resource or a new home for people, you know, elsewhere and potentially not finding it. You have a Gaelic football champion as the head of the FBI. He's American, just checking.
No, he's Irish, a U.S. naturalized citizen.
That's awesome. No, really, it's to just play around with security structure and the chain of command like that. I really like how you're playing around with it. You know, you're having fun with this particular concept.
Definitely.
I have a few questions if I may. What is the overall tone that you're looking for? Are you looking for a particular overall, you know, a constant, will she be found out? Will this be found out? Will that be found out? Are you looking for any sort of providing conspiracy threads for the reader to put together in the back of their heads? So you always have like a meta narrative going along. What overall tone If you were to compare it to a movie, what sort of films would you say it your tone closely matches?
Ah, that's a good question. At the back of it, there will always be, this thing which you mentioned of, will she be discovered? Because, as I said, sometimes the FBI's foes are not hers. And in the story that I'm working on now, the third in the series, Dawn is called to investigate a top-secret stealth submarine, which has been overtaken by aliens. And she is actually working to get the aliens away safely, while the FBI is working to capture them. So there's the double dealing going on. Will she be caught? And the stakes, will become higher for her as she goes along.
So are we looking at more like an X-Files type of feel or a Buckaroo Banzai type of feel? I mean, what kind of voice are you seeing carrying this, Tony? And do you know what Buckaroo Banzai is?
I was just going to ask you that.
Okay, that's a bad example.
I'd say Quatermass, if you're familiar with Professor Quatermass.
Yes.
Because we're just trying to nail down what that voice is that you want. Is there a tongue-in-cheek quality? Is this Robert Ludlum thriller quality? What vehicle do you see supporting the stories that you're telling? What kind of voice?
I think that is really one of the things that I'm here to ascertain, for myself to get this right from the start.
Okay. We can help with that.
Yeah, the X-Files, that had a thing of them always trying to debunk things, didn't it?
Right. But it was very serious. I mean, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. It was very dramatic and, Ludlum-esque and the stakes were high and it was a very serious piece. Buffy, for example, or even Doctor Who, takes those intensities and wrap them with a little wink and a nod every now and again. And Alicia, I don't mean to hijack your question. Am I exploring it in the way you had intended?
Please continue, Dave. You're doing fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. So, Tony, what do you think?
It will be fairly serious because, okay, Dawn will be in deadly danger if she's ever discovered.
Sure.
Now, I would love to be able to do something Buffy-esque. I'd absolutely love comedy, and when you mix it with aliens, like Red Dwarf or Third Rock from the Sun,
there you go.
Things like that, I adore those, and the way that people can put that humour in it. Unfortunately, I really struggle to put that in. Where light-hearted things come to me, where something clicks, I will put that in. But it will be fairly serious tone with, always an element of danger there.
Okay. I think that gives us a good framework to work with. Go ahead, Alicia. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump in like that.
Tony, how much do you know about the alien culture? Have you mapped that out? Have you, how much do you know? Are you able to think in your mind, all right, this is different than the culture that she's currently in. This is different than the culture she's currently in. These are all the culture shock bits.
Yes. So I've worked out how the aliens have got to Earth. And as I mentioned yesterday on the chat with Dave, where this story's come from is I've never seen or read anything myself, maybe it's been done, where somebody's really given a good answer as to exactly why the aliens are here and what they're doing. So, yes, I've mapped that out. Not all of it will be disclosed possibly to the readers, but there will be hints of it there all the time. They will be given a little bit more information as the story unfolds and as people make discoveries in their investigations.
I'm actually referring to more of the aliens' culture when they're on their original home planet or traveling around, whatever they want. Do they have what forms of currency are they using? Are they a traditional or conservative society? How do they feel about, you know, what's their family structure? How do they feel about, do they arrange marriages? Do they not? What sort of philosophies do they have? If they're not religious, do they have? Are they, you know, are they, do they have like a more dogmatic approach to religion or philosophy, or are they more easygoing? Anything like that. Like if you walk around on their own home planet, are you familiar with like what happened if you went inside of any random store on the side of the road?
They're a feudal system where the old planet was dominated by one family, you know, akin to royalty or an emperor. As far as the aliens that we encounter are concerned, they are on a one-way mission. What we see now is a slower-than-light speed form of transport, which has brought them eventually to our solar system.
Well, I think, Tony, one of the things I think what Alicia is getting at is, you know, a one-way mission to a Klingon is something different than a one-way mission to E.T.
Yes.
And is the culture, how much have you evolved of their culture to define and structure how they're engaging with each other and with humanity? Do you have an idea of what they're like on their own?
How best to describe this? We have got two cultures on this spaceship, which are the grey aliens and humanoids. Their destinies are intertwined. So what we're seeing here in the time that they have been on board the ship, because nobody on board their ship set off on it. They were all born on there.
It's like a generation ship.
They're all born in route.
Okay.
And do they have a caste system? Are the Greys superior to the humanoids?
The humanoids are superior to the Greys. And they do have a command system, you know, a chain of command on there.
That's interesting. I'm seeing some parallels with the initial Norse interactions with Britain. You know, the Norse people coming in, and well, we all know our British history, or at least some of it. But you know, as you know. Even Stephen Hawking recently stated that, you know, any interaction with a society of superior technology is really, really bad for the of the culture, which doesn't have the same technological match. So, I mean, could you see like one of Dawn's conflicts being, you know, my people could really screw up this particular these folks, and so, you know, she's not only caught between two worlds, but she's trying to protect them from each other.
That's a good point.
Yes, initially I see it as coming in peace, but that they will be circling above this war-ravaged planet of ours, wondering, you know, do we really want to make our own here? But not having the fuel to go anywhere else. So that there are quite a few conflicts which can arise from there. You know, and even with the best intentions, you can be forced into situations where you do things that you don't want to do, which can have unintended consequences.
Can you give us an example of one of those conflicts?
Yes, because I'm looking at, you know, why are the aliens here, and asking why are they allegedly abducting people. What is the purpose of that? And of course, they want to research human biology, study, you know, the way that we think and feel. And while they want to do it in the humane way, for want of a better example, actually coming down and abducting people, because you can't say to them, excuse me, do you mind while we whip you up into the sky? you know,
that would be awkward. Yeah, that'd be a tough conversation.
Yeah,
although so, a fun one to explore, actually. But carry on.
Yeah. So while they, you know, so while they've got to do that, it does cause trauma for people. It causes nightmares. And if anybody actually awakes while this is happening, they're going to be terrified. Yeah, it's that sort of thing. We want to go about this the right way, but we can't. It's awkward.
Okay.
So they're stranded. It's maybe there's parallels with Robinson Crusoe.
There you go.
And his Man Friday.
Oh, I yes. like that. Yeah.
It sounds like the focus of your story has been Dawn. Can you provide another example of a conflict that she is forced to resolve?
Well, I mean, we've got the one in the third story, you know, of her rescuing another alien thing. But I think other things which I'm looking at will be the fuel systems. They have no way now of manufacturing their own on the spaceships. So they will provide, or they have provided, scientists with their technology.
Our scientists? Human scientists?
Yes, human scientists, the alien technology to manufacture advanced fuel systems. Once I can actually set a date for when they got here, did they, for instance, give us the technology for nuclear fuel, you know, as nuclear war become a side effect of their need for this energy to power their spaceships.
How is that connected with Dawn's story?
Because she's, what's the best way of putting it? She is now involved directly with humans to interact with them, to find out all that she can about us. In some ways to steer us or the AVI along the route that she wants to go, away from where the evidence is.
It sounds like she has a lot to think about, especially if she knows that, oh my God, all this nuclear war is because of my people, you know, performing an inception in Oppenheimer's head or something like that. That sounds like you have a great deal of conspiracy fodder there, especially if you want to go in the Ludlum X-Files direction. You have the potential for her to even like find out things that the aliens did, which they didn't even tell her about. Maybe there's a mistake. Maybe one of them made a huge blunder covered it up, and she found out about it and told her, you know, her people. Maybe some of her people like were part of the conspiracy and so they want to shut her up. So you get conspiracies on both sides.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that. Cause then she can question her whole mission and her whole loyalty. And it plays back beautifully into the need to belong and accepted theme that is running as an undercurrent here. That's gorgeous. I like that.
Yes.
One other thing I think is fascinating, I just want to get back to the fact, is that you said they come from a feudal society, which you have like the one family on top. So there's, you know, there's a great deal of European, you know, in European conquest of lands who aren't, you know, familiar with them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Doc, what about you, sir? What are your impressions of Tony's story and any ideas that are burbling in that frothy head of yours?
See, I've been trying to keep track of this stuff and see if I can sort it out. Now, you mentioned that Dawn was an alien hybrid, and you mentioned at least one other character that was an alien hybrid.
Yes.
Where did these hybrids come from?
They have come from the genetic material of the species on the shape.
Who decided it was a good idea to create them? Was this something that the FBI did? This is the aliens' way of infiltrating the Earth, is to create hybrids with the local species. Who thought it was a good idea to combine the genetic material of two different species?
The aliens have done. They have incorporated the Greys material, which is, you know, when you see them, they have huge eyes, don't they? And no ears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how they're usually portrayed. So my theory of that is that they can see extremely well in the dark, and they have tiny mouths and virtually no ears because they communicate telepathically. So by giving these agents, Dawn and Anne, these abilities, it helps, it gives them an advantage, you know, in our society. They can communicate with each other across a crowded room, you know.
Let me jump in and expand on Doc's question, just for clarification. Tony, are these humans that are genetically modified with this DNA, or are these people grown in vats and evolve? Because you spoke about Dawn's mother, so that kind of implies that she was born to one or the other species and then genetically modified. How does that work?
They will be born to alien humanoids, we are now. Our scientists are altering the genetics at the level of the egg, aren't they? They're taking the egg out of... Okay. Mothers altering the genetics there, and then implanting it back into the wound.
Okay.
So Dawn and Anne are children of alien humanoid mothers who,
yes,
they've been combined with some human DNA, supposedly so that they can pass among humans.
The difference here is Anne hasn't got any human DNA, as in anybody living on this planet. She has got the DNA of the humanoid aliens. So she is pure alien. She's got the humanoid alien plus some of the grey alien in her. Now, the difference with Dawn, she is the only one to have any human tissue in a taken from somebody on this planet.
Okay, cool.
Okay. So you've got Dawn and Anne, and they're interacting with the FBI. Am I correct?
Dawn,
or at least Dawn is.
Yeah, Dawn has been recruited directly to the FBI.
Does the FBI know that she's alien?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so she's a sleeper agent for the aliens working with the FBI.
She's absolutely an active agent.
She's undercover. She's, I'm sorry, sleeper is the wrong word. Right. She's an undercover agent for the aliens working with the FBI.
Yes.
And she considers the aliens to be her people. She doesn't really understand humanity, and you said her motivation was that she's looking for a new home for her people.
Yes.
Is she treated by the aliens as if, as one of them? Does she really belong with the aliens, or do they kind of look at her askance because she's the only one with this human DNA in? You know, the humans are weird. Is she going to get weird too?
That's a good question. That could have some possibilities.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
No, they do look up to Dawn because her mother is the last of the royal line.
So she's an heir to the royal line?
Yes.
Oh, there's all kinds of fun you could have there.
Such as?
Oh, well, she's the only heir to the ruling line of this group of humanoid aliens, but she's not pure blood.
That's
so
the Captain of Aragon.
Yeah, so yeah. You've got people there who are going to say,
oh hell no.
If she doesn't survive and her mother doesn't have any other children, then somebody is going to have to step up and take over. So now you have alien intrigue trying to pull power away from the ruling line to set up a new one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm wondering, sorry to break in, just really quick. Tony, can you provide us with an example of the discrimination that Anne faces, that the Greys would put on her? Like, does she have to use, like, the wooden utensils? She can't use the good silver or something like that?
You know, I hadn't actually thought that much through on there, but that is the difference in that Anne has two humanoid parents, two alien humanoid parents, with you know, as we said earlier, some grey DNA. Yes, I will make notes of that, of exactly how this does play out.
Guys, I hate to jump in like this, but we are desperately running low on time. So what I'd like to do, if we can, is to go around the table, Alicia, Doc, and myself, and sum up the ideas that have sparked some of the possibilities. You know, again, understanding that Tony has done a lot of work on a very rich framework here. And I think one of the best things that we can do is take a look at that framework and explore, you know, Alicia, you were talking about some of the similarities between Robinson Crusoe and the Norse incursion into England. Let's go up to those thematic levels and explore different aspects in summary of some things that Tony could explore, some things that maybe he hasn't considered, or some things that are in place that, if looked at from a different perspective, could infuse the story with something that will capture Tony's imagination and the reader's. Alicia, go ahead. Can you start us off with that? Do you have what has really captured your attention? What would you like to see explored or that hasn't been?
I'm feeling a really strong Mission Impossible vibe from this story. I love the concept of the girl and her backup team working against the authorities, the FBI, in order to do things where you could get a very intricate series of what you do, what do the aliens do when they get in the hospitals. That could be compromised. You could get the situation of which the aliens are like, okay, you know, with modern hospitals, the chances of getting compromised are almost 100%. So either this boy's compromised, we're going to take him out unless you guys can do X, Y, and Z. So you have, you know, a very much of a whole ticking clock going, which I think you already have. So like the whole the Norse incursion concepts, as we were saying before, those are, I think, very, very distant to you. They're more framing devices. They're not necessarily things you want to go into. It sounds like you want to do more with the Mission Impossible style series of adventures in which people are, you know, oh my God, this could be found, this could be found, this could be found, and then you have, of course, the slightly clueless but, you know, could possibly dangerous Mr. Scott, who could, you know, who could throw the whole thing open, and yet at the same time he's a valuable ally. I love the concept of throwing that sort of thing from, you know, Mission Impossible is like a government organization, you know, or occasionally goes rogue, but making it alien and crossing with X-Files, you have the potential to really push the adventure quotient. You have the potential to push the Tom Clancy, I really, I recommend pushing the story in reveling into kind of the whole spy genre mixed with Tom Clancy vibe that it sounds like you're really going for.
Yeah. Excellent. Doc, what about you, sir? Final, give a summary of stuff you want to see and could explore and what's working, what do you want to see more of?
Well, I don't know how much it applies for this first story, but if this is going to be part of a series, I see some interesting ways of exploring racial themes. I mean, you've got humanoids, the Greys, and humans, and there's all this stuff about how do they relate to each other. Now, the humans not so much with the other aliens, but definitely in terms of... you said the humanoids are over the Greys. It's like, are the Greys considered a subrace? Are they only tolerated because they have useful skills? Then are the hybrids with the Greys accepted? You know, they're obviously created because the Grey genetic material provides certain talents, but are they fully accepted into society, or are they treated strangely? And you've got a main character who's trying to find a new home for her people, but there's no guarantee that she's actually going to be accepted by her people. And there's all kinds of caught between the worlds angles that you can explore in greater depth through the series, especially if Dawn actually, through all of her interacting with humanity, starts to begin to understand humanity and starts to say, okay, maybe these people aren't that bad. Maybe these people might actually, in some ways, be better than my own people.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think something on that, Doc, which I'm looking at, and I've already started to write it in here, is, you know, not only the way that we're always going to war with each other, but the lengths we will go to, you know, to take something off other people, you know, as Alicia said about our wars of conquest. So Dawn is going to, I think, start from fairly idealistic, but she's going to encounter firsthand just how devious we can be. And that is going to shape her experience.
Very much so. Very much so.
Yeah, you got the whole progression of Blake's Age of Innocence to Age of Experience going.
Yes, yes.
One last thing I would love to see. I would love to see the alien plan in motion. I would like to, as a reader, I would like to know there's a plan. I would like to know some of the steps. And I would like to see how Dawn is involved in each of the steps. I would like to see how things go wrong with their plan, how she fixes it, how she feels conflicted about her fixes, how her friends help her out or make things worse or whatever. I'd also like to see something more with the boy. Is the boy important? And or if he's not, can something happen that suddenly makes him really important and vital to the mission?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yes, I'm looking at the story arc on that. You know, I obviously can't introduce him in the first story and he'll never be seen again. Right. You know, and the same with the captive. I've got him in the second story. And of course, it's the spaceship, whether she has to destroy that, even if it means doing it in a building full of scientists. If she has to destroy it, nice. And kill them all, that's what she will have to do.
Yeah.
Very nice. Good conflict.
Yes, absolutely.
I guess my other question is, does this alien plan involve subjugating humanity or eliminating humanity?
Well, and I think that's one of the key points that let me riff a little bit. Let me give you my final summary as we wrap this up, Tony.
Go for it.
First of all, I love fundamentally the theme that you listed first out, the need to belong and be accepted. And I think going back to that time and time again is going to make this series very not only interesting and fraught with conflict and inner turmoil, but also relevant to everyone, because you know it's Dawn's need to be accepted. It's the aliens' need for acceptance on some level, whether it's to find a new home or to conquer one. And I don't think that question should be answered right up front. In fact, I'm not even sure the aliens necessarily need to know themselves, because that need of acceptance is a very human thing. It's a very life thing. It's very appropriate for any life form, any community-driven life form, to feel that. So that, I think, is really, really relevant. God, I got so much here. Alicia was asking about the culture of the aliens, and you've actually told us a great deal about it, whether you're aware of it or not. In Dawn's strict moral code, that would have come from the aliens, either their interpretation of human values and morals and ethics, or from the aliens themselves. I mean, there's going to be, she literally is a fusion of the genetic culture, but the culture of the aliens that raised her and the humans whose whole task, her whole life, has been leading towards this mission of infiltration. And the fact that she has a strict moral code that she follows to the letter, to the detriment of some of the people around her, I think, is very telling about the culture that evolved her. You also have them abducting humans for research, which is not nice. It's not gentle. It's no. Invasive. It's cruel. It's inhuman, is what it is. That also is revealing of how these aliens, at least this faction of aliens that's conducting these research elements, consider the human race. And I think that right there, you know, Alicia touched on it, Doc touched on it, and I think those are both valid points. The fact that there are strata and factions within this alien generation ship that is, you know, hiding behind the moon or has cloaking technology, however it is that we haven't found it yet, or maybe it's crashed on the planet somewhere and they're existing from inside, doesn't matter. The culture within this alien city, the last remnants of an alien race, I think is fuel for all sorts of amazing infusions into Dawn's story as they fight within themselves and maybe even have a civil war within their own faction to determine, are we conquering these people or are we going to engage with them and seek them out as friends? There's lots of material out there in the world right now. You know, V, the TV series V, the old one and the new one, has touched on these themes. Also, the event that revealed that aliens have been among us for years and they brought about nuclear power in the hopes of finding a power system for their own trans-dimensional technologies, blah, blah, blah. So there's definitely precedent to be explored from there.
Don't forget the TV version of War of the Worlds from the 80s, which is basically very much like Tony's concept, right, where the aliens, you know, became humans.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you're definitely tapping a good, rich thematic line here. The revelation that she's the last of the royal line is a whole different plot line that could lead to all kinds of civil war. You know, do people want her as their leader? I'm sure there's a faction that does. There's going to be a faction that doesn't. We'll actually be working against her, maybe even want her dead. When you described Dawn initially and through the discussion that we've had, the one character template that seemed to really resonate for me is that Dawn is the alien's Neo from The Matrix.
I like that.
She is the hope. She's the complete separate. She's utterly isolated. She has no home among the humans. She really has no home among the aliens, ultimately. She's not one of them. She's been created. She's unique in that respect. And my God, what an isolating, horrifyingly alone status she's been thrust into. And it sounds like you're really exploring that. That's awesome.
So, Dave, if I can revisit the idea of aliens working against her. So you're going to have a group of aliens wanting her dead using just alien side and another group who wants her dead, who is actively aiding the FBI so that they can discover that she's an alien.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, the layers, the factions yeah. involved. I mean, one thing, Tony, I think that would really behoove you is identifying those factions, all of them, and what yeah. their objectives are in the context of this thing. And the aliens, I would say, you know, there is no going back. And I think you mentioned that, but let really play that up, you know, and give them a ticking clock. Maybe, I don't know, their life support materials are breaking down, or, you know, the inner struggle of this containment, because they've been living on this ship for generations. Maybe that's breaking down. Maybe, you know, in the next, if they don't find a resolution to this in the next year or so, you know, it's going to be anarchy, chaos, death, mayhem, the end of a culture, an end of a civilization. I don't know, but...
On that point, Dave, I have written a story as a big budget live action film script, which does explain all of this, and we're introduced to her mother, and you will see not only the clicky the ticking clock, but awesome. You know exactly where it is going to end.
Very cool. That's good that you've got supporting and collateral material out there that's infusing this universe. Cause that's awesome. One last thing, and then I'll wrap it up. There, at one point, you said you can't very well go up and ask somebody, "Can I abduct you and flay you alive to research your genetic material?" And as soon as I hear "can't," my initial thought is, "Oh yes, you can." What if, you know, the aliens have a subculture of humans who are so frickin' pumped that there's aliens out there, and that one of the factions, or maybe the whole species, has actually cultivated in secret, unbeknownst to anyone, the FBI or the alien race, this whole subculture of humans that know that they're here and willingly submit to research, because we really haven't heard a lot about alien abductions recently. Maybe that's because they've found a willing stock of humans who love the idea of being probed by aliens in exchange for stuff like that. Something to consider, because that introduces a different faction and a different aspect of human culture, because God knows we're fixated on UFOs and aliens.
That's very similar to the concept of the humans who want to give themselves willingly to vampires. It helps vampires stay in the dark.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so you've got this whole army of humans that are actually on Dawn's side that maybe she doesn't find out about for several stories, but give you that as well. So,
yeah.
Wow. Guys.
Imagine just finding an army, you know, that belongs to you. That is a very, very powerful concept. And I know that nobody has ever done anything like that in a big budget movie episode 2 before.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Guys, nice. I got to wrap this up. We are way over time. Tony, thank you so much, man, for bringing your story forward and fostering some very intriguing discussion. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you to everybody there for your input. And your feedback. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. Alicia, thank you for coming in and infusing the story with some wonderful perspectives and analogs and asking some very probing questions. This was a good discussion.
You said probe.
I did say probe. Because I've got aliens in the brain. And Doc, thank you, sir, for stepping in and being my fearless co-host. I know Brian appreciates it, and I do too.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
Oh, anytime, sir. The chair is always warm for you, and I know Brian appreciates it, so very cool. Friends, thank you very much for tuning in, as always. Give us some love. Spread the word. Let the good news go out that the roundtable is out there. Next week, we start it all over. New guest hosts, new guest writers, new stories to kick around. I know it's going to be awesome. We will continue the pursuit of literary gold. Doc, any closing thoughts as we wrap this bad boy up?
Just go forth and go right.
Go forth and go right, absolutely. Write about aliens living among us. So friends, the world is your oyster. There's all sorts of treasure out there. All you gotta do is find it. You find what you're looking for, so look for the wow. Until next time, I'm Dave Robison, your host with the Roundtable Podcast. For Doc Coleman, Tony Sunderland, and Alicia Goranson, we thank you, and we will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.